Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Worlds by Eric Flint. Narrated by Keith Sellenwright. Preface. As an author, I'm almost a pure novelist. By good fortune, I happened to become a professional writer at a time when the market for science fiction and fantasy had become completely dominated by novels, and series at that. Not even standalone novels. That worked very nicely for me personally, since novels, especially series, are my natural inclination as a writer. But that's not really why I work almost entirely in long-form writing. It's just good luck. I'd have done the same thing 40 or 50 years ago when science fiction and fantasy was a predominantly short-form genre. Even though, in all likelihood, I'd never have been able to make a living as a writer. Which I can do today. It's just the way my brain works, that's all. When I first started writing fiction, like most aspiring authors, I tried to write short fiction. That's because I thought that it'd be much easier to get professionally published with short stories than with novels. That's not actually true today, as I discovered soon enough. If anything, there's less competition for novels than there is for short fiction. True enough, a typical novel publishing house will receive hundreds of manuscripts from unpublished authors every year, from which they will only select a literal handful. But a major commercial fantasy and science fiction magazine will get that many submissions every month, from which they will select perhaps one or two from unpublished authors, if they select any at all. The big drawback to launching a writing career with novels, or trying to, isn't actually the level of competition. It's that an aspiring writer obviously has to commit a far greater amount of time and effort to writing a novel than a short story. You can write a short story in days. Writing a novel, for all but the very fastest writers, takes several months and can easily take a year or two if you're working a full-time job. The problem I always had with short fiction is that I simply couldn't start telling a story until I'd gotten the setting and background very well worked out. And once I'd done that and started writing, I invariably found myself writing a short story that was actually a novel in disguise and would work far better as a novel in the first place. The only exceptions were a few short stories I wrote with a purely humorous purpose. So, finally, I accepted the inevitable. I stopped trying to write short fiction and concentrated instead entirely on writing novels. And that's how my career got started. I'd published 5 novels and had several more under contract before I even tried to write short fiction again. The reason I did, then, was because David Drake commissioned me to write a novella for an anthology, Foreign Legions, published in 2001, that was based in his Ranks of Bronze setting. Any professional writer hates to turn down work, following the principle that a bird in the hand is worth 2 in the bush. So, despite my misgivings, I accepted the commission. At that point, an interesting thing happened. I discovered that I didn't have any trouble writing that novella. Cartago Delenda Est, which is included in this book, because David had already developed the setting and background. I found it quite easy to situate myself in an existing universe and simply figure out a story that would work just fine, despite being much shorter than my normal inclination. A short time later, David Weber commissioned another story from me, this one to be included in an anthology of stories set in the universe of his very popular Honor Harrington series. In this instance, Day wanted either a long novella or a short novel, not the short novella that Drake had commissioned. The end result turned out to be the short novel From the Highlands, which is also included in this book. And again, I made the same discovery. As long as the setting was already established, I had no trouble writing in any length from short story on up. Within a couple of years, I'd written several other pieces, most of them set in my own 1632 universe, the shortest of which is only 3,000 words long. That's portraits, also included herein. Once the logjam got broken, I wound up writing quite a bit of short fiction. Not as much, to be sure, as I wrote novels. But eventually, I realized that I'd written enough short fiction to produce, if collected together, a very hefty anthology. So I proposed to Jim Bain that Bain Books produce such an anthology, and he accepted. The result you are listening to right now. This is something of an oddball collection of short fiction, I admit. The typical such collection is a number of unrelated short stories, each of which stands entirely on its own, whereas almost all of my short fiction is set in an existing universe, usually a series of my own, but sometimes that of another author, and many of the stories are related more directly still to novels or other stories in that series. Still, I think every one of these stories can be enjoyed on its own. And it's my hope, of course, that if anyone listening to this anthology finds their interest being taken by one or another of the stories in it, they'll be inspired to investigate the novels in which that universe or universes are more fully developed. So, welcome to my worlds. Eric Flint, September 2008. The Belisarius Series. Author's Note. This is the fourth version of this story. I originally wrote it as a novella to be included in the anthology War Masters, published by Bain Books in 2002. After the hardcover edition appeared in May of that year, I decided that the story would be improved by adding a penultimate episode just before the existing ending. That episode was included in the version that was reissued in the mass-market edition of War Masters, which came out in February 2004. In 2005, when I sat down to write the final novel in the Belisarius series, The Dance of Time, my original intention was to include Islands as an appendix to the novel, since the story serves in some respects as a bridge between the fifth volume, The Tide of Victory, and the last one. But my co-author Dave Drake convinced me that it would be better if I wove the various episodes of Islands into The Dance of Time as one of the subplots. So I did so, polishing and slightly expanding the existing story. In the novel subplot, I also continued the later adventures of Calipodius and Anna. But those events are not integral to this story, which stands on its own, so they're not included here. So that was the third version, and this is the fourth, which is the reassembly of the story as a standalone novella for this anthology, which I did by using the later and improved version I wrote for the novel. When all is said and done, I still think the same thing I thought when I first wrote the story. It's probably the best piece of short fiction I've ever written, certainly in some respects, and it's one of the best things I've ever written in any length. The fact that the story can handle being shaped and reshaped so often is simply a reflection of that. The one thing all good stories have in common is that they are very, very tough. Islands. 1. Bukur Island on the Indus River. He dreamed mostly of islands, oddly enough. He was sailing now in one of his father's pleasure crafts. Not the luxurious barge in all but name and glitter which his father himself preferred for the family's outings into the Golden Horn, but in the Phaselos, which was suited for sailing in the open sea. Unlike his father, for whom sailing expeditions were merely excuses for political or commercial transactions, Calipodius had always loved sailing for its own sake. Besides, it gave him and his new wife something to do besides sit together in stiff silence. Calipodius's half-sleeping reverie was interrupted. Wakefulness came with the sound of his aide-de-camp Luke moving through the tent. The heaviness with which Luke clumped about was deliberate, designed to allow his master to recognize who had entered his domicile. Luke was quite capable of moving easily and lightly, as he had proved many times in the course of the savage fighting on Bukur Island. But the man, in this as so many things, had proven to be far more subtle than his rough and muscular appearance might suggest. "It's morning, young Calipodius," Luke announced. "Time to clean your wounds. And you're not eating enough." Calipodius sighed. The process of tending the wounds would be painful, despite all of Luke's care. As for the other, have new provisions arrived? There was a moment's silence, then reluctantly, no. Callipodius let the silence lengthen. After a few seconds, he heard Luke's own heavy sigh. We're getting very low, truth to tell. Ashot hasn't much himself until the supply ships arrive. Callipodius levered himself up on his elbows. Then I will eat my share, no more. He chuckled, perhaps a bit harshly. And don't try to cheat, Luke. I have other sources of information you may know. As if my hardest job of the day won't be to keep half the army from parading through this tent, snorted Luke. Callipodius felt the weight of Luke's knees pressing into the pallet next to him, and a moment later winced as the bandages over his head began to be removed. You're quite the soldier's favorite, lad, added Luke softly. Don't think otherwise. In the painful time that followed, as Luke scoured and cleaned and rebandaged the sockets that had once been eyes, Callipodius tried to take refuge in that knowledge. It helped. Some. Are there any signs of another Malwa attack coming? He asked some time later. Callipodius was now perched in one of the bastions his men had rebuilt after an enemy assault had overrun it, before, eventually, the Malwa had been driven off the island altogether. That had required bitter and ferocious fighting, however, which had inflicted many casualties upon the Roman defenders. His eyes had been among those casualties, ripped out by shrapnel from a mortar shell. After the bloody beating we gave him the last time, chortled one of the soldiers who shared the bastion. Not likely, sir. Callipodius tried to match the voice to a remembered face. As usual, the effort failed of its purpose. But he took some time to engage in small talk with the soldier so as to fix the voice itself in his memory. Not for the first time, Callipodius reflected wryly on the way in which possession of vision seemed to dull all other human faculties. Since his blinding, he had found his memory growing more accurate along with his hearing. A simple instinct for self-preservation, he imagined. A blind man had to remember better than a seeing man, since he no longer had vision to constantly jog his lazy memory. After his chat with the soldier had gone on for a few minutes, the man cleared his throat and said diffidently, You'd best leave here, sir, if you'll pardon me for saying so. The Malwa'll likely be starting another barrage soon. For a moment, fierce good cheer filled the man's voice. They seem to have a particular grudge against this part of our line, seeing how their own blood and guts make up a good part of it. The remark produced a ripple of harsh chuckling from the other soldiers crouched in the fortifications. That bastion had been one of the most hotly contested areas when the Malwa launched their major attack the week before. Callipodius didn't doubt for a moment that when his soldiers repaired the damage to the earthen walls, they had not been too fastidious about removing all the traces of the carnage. He sniffed, tentatively, detecting those traces. His olfactory sense, like his hearing, had grown more acute also. Must have stunk right afterward, he commented. The same soldier issued another harsh chuckle. That it did, sir, that it did. Why, God invented flies, the way I look at it. Callipodius felt Luke's heavy hand on his shoulder. Time to go, sir. There'll be a barrage coming, sure enough. In times past, Callipodius would have resisted. But he no longer felt any need to prove his courage, and a part of him, a still wondering 18-year-old part, understood that his safety had become something his own men cared about. Alive, somewhere in the rear, but still on the island, Callipodius would be a source of strength for his soldiers in the event of another Malwa onslaught. Spiritual strength, if not physical, a symbol, if nothing else. But men, fighting men perhaps more than any others, live by such symbols. So he allowed Luke to guide him out of the bastion and down the rough staircase which led to the trenches below. On the way, Callipotius gauged the steps with his feet. "One of these logs is too big," he said, speaking firmly but trying to keep any critical edge out of the words. "It's a waste there. Better to use it for another fake cannon." He heard Luke suppress a sigh. "And will you stop fussing like a hen?" was the content of that small sound. Callipotius suppressed a laugh. Luke, in truth, made a poor servant. "We've got enough," replied Luke curtly. 20-odd. Do any more and the Malwa will get suspicious. We've only got 3 real ones left to keep up the pretense. As they moved slowly through the trench, Callipotius considered the problem and decided that Luke was right. The pretense was probably threadbare by now anyway. When the Malwa finally launched a full-scale amphibious assault on the island that was the centerpiece of Callipotius's diversion, they had overrun half of it before being beaten back. When the survivors returned to the main Malwa army besieging the city of Sukkur across the Indus, they would have reported to their own top commanders that several of the cannons with which the Romans had apparently festooned their fortified island were nothing but painted logs. But how many? That question would still be unclear in the minds of the enemy. Not all of them, for a certainty. When Belisarius took his main force to outflank the Malwa in the Punjab, leaving behind Callipotius and fewer than 2,000 men to serve as a diversion, he had also left some of the field guns and mortars. Those pieces had savaged the Malwa attackers when they finally grew suspicious enough to test the real strength of Callipotius's position. "The truth is," said Luke gruffly, "it doesn't really matter anyway." Again the heavy hand settled on Callipotius's slender shoulder, this time giving it a little squeeze of approval. "You've already done what the general asked you to, lad. Kept the Malwa confused, thinking Belisarius was still here, while he marched in secret to the northeast. Did it as well as he could have possibly hoped." They had reached one of the covered portions of the trench, Callipotius sensed. He couldn't see the earth-covered logs, which gave some protection from enemy fire, of course, but the quality of sound was a bit different within a shelter than in an open trench. That was just one of the many little auditory subtleties which Callipotius had begun noticing lately. He had not noticed it in times past, before he lost his eyes. In the first days after Belisarius and the main army left Sukkur on their secret forced march to outflank the Malwa in the Punjab, Callipotius had noticed very little, in truth. He had had neither the time nor the inclination to ponder the subtleties of sense perception. He had been far too excited by his new and unexpected command and by the challenge it posed. Martial glory. The blind young man in the covered trench stopped for a moment, staring through sightless eyes at a wall of earth and timber bracing, remembering and wondering. The martial glory Callipotius had sought when he left a new wife in Constantinople had certainly come to him. Of that he had no doubt at all. His own soldiers thought so and said so often enough, those who had survived, and Callipotius was quite certain that his praises would soon be spoken in the Senate. Precious few of the Roman Empire's most illustrious families had achieved any notable feats of arms in the great war against the Malwa. Beginning with the top commander Belisarius himself, born into the lower Thracian nobility, it had been largely a war fought by men from low stations in life, commoners in the main. Agathias, the now-famous hero of Anatha and the Dam, had been born into a baker's family, about as menial a position as any short of outright slavery. Other than Sittus, who was now leading Belisarius's cataphracts in the Punjab, almost no Greek nobleman had fought in the Malwa War. And even Sittus, before the Indus campaign, had spent the war commanding the garrison in Constantinople that overawed the hostile aristocracy and kept the dynasty on the throne. Had it been worth it? Reaching up and touching gently the emptiness which had once been his eyes, Callipotius was still not sure. Like many other young members of the nobility, he had been swept up with enthusiasm after the news came that Belisarius had shattered the Malwa in Mesopotamia. Let the adult members of the aristocracy whine and complain in their salons. The youth were burning to serve. And serve they had, but only as couriers in the beginning. It hadn't taken Callipotius long to realize that Belisarius intended to use him and his high-born fellows mainly for liaison with the haughty Persians, who were even more obsessed with nobility of bloodline than Greeks. The posts carried prestige. The couriers rode just behind Belisarius himself in formation, but little in the way of actual responsibility. Standing in the bunker, the blind young man chuckled harshly. He used us, you know, as cold-blooded as a reptile. Silence for a moment. Then Callipotius heard Luke take a deep breath.
Aye, lad, he did. The general will use anyone if he feels it necessary.
Callipotius nodded. He felt no anger at the thought. He simply wanted it acknowledged. He reached out his hand and felt the rough wall of the bunker with fingertips grown sensitive with blindness. Texture of soil, which he would never have noticed before, came like a flood of dark light. He wondered for a moment how his wife's breasts would feel to him, or her belly, or her thighs, now. He didn't imagine he would ever know, and dropped the hand. Callipotius did not expect to survive the war now that he was blind, not unless he used the blindness as a reason to return to Constantinople and spent the rest of his life resting on his laurels. The thought was unbearable. I am only 18. My life should still be ahead of me. That thought brought a final decision. Given that his life was now forfeit, Callipotius intended to give it the full measure while it lasted. Menander should be arriving soon, with the supply ships.
Yes, said Luke.
When he arrives, I wish to speak with him.
Yes, said Luke. The servant hesitated, then, what about?
Again, Callipotius chuckled harshly.
Another forlorn hope.
He began moving slowly through the bunker to the tunnel which led back to his headquarters. Having lost my eyes on this island, it seems only right I should lose my life on another. Belisarius's island this time. Not the one he left behind to fool the enemy. The real island, not the false one.
There was nothing false about this island, young man, growled Luke. Never say it. Malwa was broken here as surely as it was on any battlefield of Belisarius. There is the blood of Roman soldiers to prove it, along with your own eyes. Most of all,
by some means he could not specify, Callipotius understood that Luke was gesturing angrily to the north.
Most of all, by the fact that we kept an entire Malwa army pinned here for 2 weeks, by your cunning and our sweat and blood, while Belisarius slipped unseen to the north. 2 weeks! The time he needed to slide a lance into Malwa's unprotected flank. We gave him that time. We did. You did.
He heard Luke's almost shuddering intake of breath. So never speak of a false island again, boy. Is a shield false and only a sword true? Stupid. The general did what he needed to do, and so did you. Take pride in it, for there was nothing false in that doing. Callipotius could not help lowering his head. No, he whispered. But was it worth the doing? The Indus River in the Punjab, Belisarius's headquarters, the Iron Triangle. I know I shouldn't have come, General, but... Callipotius groped for words to explain. He could not find any. It was impossible to explain to someone else the urgency he felt, since it would only sound suicidal, which in truth it almost was, at least in part. But
Maybe I could help you with supplies or something.
No matter, stated Belisarius firmly, giving Calipodius's shoulder a squeeze. The general's large hand was very powerful. Calipodius was a little surprised by that. His admiration for Belisarius bordered on idolization, but he had never really given any thought to the general's physical characteristics. He had just been dazzled, first by the man's reputation, then, after finally meeting him in Mesopotamia, by the relaxed humor and confidence with which he ran his staff meetings. The large hand on his shoulder began gently leading Calipodius off the dock where Menander's ship had tied up.
"I can still count, even if—"
"Forget that," growled Belisarius. "I've got enough clerks," with a chuckle. "The quartermasters don't have that much to count anyway. We're on very short rations here."
Again, the hand squeezed his shoulder, not with sympathy this time, so much as assurance.
"The truth is, lad, I'm delighted to see you. We're relying on telegraph up here, in this new little fortified half-island we've created, to concentrate our forces quickly enough when the Malwa launch another attack. But the telegraph's a new thing for everyone, and keeping the communications straight and orderly has turned into a mess. My command bunker is full of people shouting at cross purposes. I need a good officer who can take charge and organize the damn thing."
Cheerfully,
"That's you, lad. Being blind won't be a handicap at all for that work. Probably be a blessing."
Calipodius wasn't certain if the general's cheer was real, or simply assumed for the purpose of improving the morale of a badly maimed subordinate. Even as young as he was, Calipodius knew that the commander he admired was quite capable of being as calculating as he was cordial. But, almost despite himself, he began feeling more cheerful.
"Well, there's this much," he said, trying to match the general's enthusiasm. "My tutors thought highly of my grammar and rhetoric, as I believe I mentioned once. If nothing else, I'm sure I can improve the quality of the messages."
The general laughed. The gaiety of the sound cheered up Calipodius even more than the general's earlier words. It was harder to feign laughter than words. Calipodius was not guessing about that. A blind man aged quickly in some ways, and Calipodius had become an expert on the subject of false laughter in the weeks since he lost his eyes. This was real. This was something he could do. A future which had seemed empty began to fill with color again. Only the colors of his own imagination, of course. But Calipodius, remembering discussions on philosophy with learned scholars in faraway and long-ago Constantinople, wondered if reality was anything but images in the mind. If so, perhaps blindness was simply a matter of custom.
"Yes," he said, with reborn confidence. "I can do that." For the first 2 days, the command bunker was a madhouse for Calipodius. But by the end of that time, he had managed to bring some semblance of order and procedure to the way in which telegraph messages were received and transmitted. Within a week, he had the system functioning smoothly and efficiently. The general praised him for his work. So, too, in subtle little ways, did the 12 men under his command. Calipodius found the latter more reassuring than the former. He was still a bit uncertain whether Belisarius's approval was due, at least in part, to the general's obvious feeling of guilt that he was responsible for the young officer's blindness. Whereas the men who worked for him, veterans all, had seen enough mutilation in their lives not to care about yet another cripple. Had the young nobleman not been a blessing to them, but rather a curse, they would not have let sympathy stand in the way of criticism. And the general, Calipodius was well aware, kept an ear open to the sentiments of his soldiers. Throughout that first week, Calipodius paid little attention to the ferocious battle which was raging beyond the heavily timbered and fortified command bunker. He traveled nowhere beyond the short distance between that bunker and the small one, not much more than a covered hole in the ground, where he and Luke had set up what passed for living quarters. Even that...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?